My name is Michael Weinman. I am a professor of philosophy at Eclav Bard. I received my PhD in philosophy, writing a dissertation on pleasure in Aristotle's Ethics at the New School for Social Research in 2005. Prior to that, I'd received a master's degree from the New School for Social Research, and prior to that, I earned a Bachelor of the Arts in, I earned a Bachelor of the Arts from Scheimer College in Waukegan, Illinois. So I actually earned my first degree at an institution that is probably more like the institution at which I teach than those two institutions are like any other institution in the world. This is my great pleasure and fortune in life that I was able to study at such a place when I was 18 and that I get to teach at such a place now. My primary areas of research are in Greek philosophy and in political philosophy, and in the intersection between Greek philosophy and political philosophy. My current projects within those fields include a long-term research project on Greek mathematics, on their origins and their reception in, so their origins in earlier pre-classical mathematics and their reception in Hellenistic philosophy, in Christian, so particularly Neoplatonist philosophy, and then through the early modern period and down to today. This is a very broad project that has a number of elements. But I also pursue research right now on different aspects of the relevance of Aristotle's conception of nature in debates that we engage in today with respect, for instance, to sex and sexual difference, which I published about in 2011, with respect to cosmopolitanism and the idea of European identity, for instance, which I have an article that will come out this year, and about education. So very much what we're doing at ECLA, actually, more or less, this year, a piece will come out in something called the Bloomsbury Companion to Aristotle, which basically is Michael's explanation of what we do at ECLA. So in this sense, my teaching and my research are actually very intimately connected, both in terms of what I publish, actually. The name ECLA doesn't come up, but certainly our practices do. But also that I think my research very closely influences what I do in the classroom in a very organic way and without anyone ever being asked to read anything that I've published, which I wouldn't want to do. For me, though it's very difficult for me to convince my colleagues in disciplinary philosophy of this fact, the various projects that I take up are very closely interwoven, precisely because they pick up on not something that I learned in my graduate training, but rather on a certain intuition that really rests at the heart of the kind of undergraduate education that I received, which is an intuition that, though it would be false in a historical sense, and perhaps ideologically driven to say that certain insights into how things are began, first of all, with the Greeks, whoever they were, It nevertheless is true to say that the best and most direct way to understand what we don't understand at the close of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century is by thinking about the ways in which what has been called a Greek understanding of the world came to be constructed in the 19th century and still informs much of the disciplinary apparatus or the disciplinary structure of contemporary knowledge production, by which I mean that in our universities, in our research institutes, publications, teaching, all across the knowledge industry, we operate on certain assumptions about who needs to know what and where the disciplines that we learn usually in our post-secondary education, where they come from and what they're about. And so my project, all these different specific research projects, but my project in general, is to call that into question. And I think the way that you call that into question is by showing just how much there is in the classical period, and especially the 5th and 4th centuries BCE, in Greek thought, or what can be called Greek thought, that remains novel, that remains incompletely understood today. So that's why I got started in this path, that's why my dissertation ended up being on Aristotle, and that's why I think that thinking about political questions, ostensibly political questions like cosmopolitanism or sexual difference or the role of education in society go hand in hand with thinking about seemingly arcane subjects like the history of Greek mathematics. It's very funny because just now we were looking at the fifth book of the Republic, and there's a moment, it's actually at 472d in book five of the Republic, I believe, where Socrates says it was for the sake of a paradigm that we ask this question about justice and so on and so forth. And I think this is exactly the idea. So method is not bad, but I think that method, which of course is just a Greek word or a contraction of two Greek words that we find all over the place in these thinkers, but didn't have the abstraction that method has in contemporary language. Method isn't bad, it's how you think about something that's indicative of what you learn and what you do. So I think that it's, broadly speaking, true that it's because of the interest in method that 5th and 4th century Greek knowledge production, so in all its senses, the philosophical texts that we have, the mathematical advances that were made and then only written down sometime later, the architecture of the period, the music of the period to the extent that we can reconstruct what it was like. In all these modes of cultural production, which were always, in some sense, knowledge production, they were hoping to inspire some kind of learning in the audience. There's an attention to method that makes them very contemporary. I think that that's true, but I would want to think of method in this sense as being not a set of procedures that are canonically established, something like what method or methods mean, that we know, for instance, that there are methods of argumentation in philosophy, or there are certain quantitative methods that have to do with the use of statistical sampling, say, in the social sciences. and so on, but really method in a more, let's say, open sense or a more originary sense, which would be an understanding of the ways in which how you do what you do influences the outcome of what you do, whatever it is that you're doing. If, for instance, I say, as I would, that thinking about what Aristotle says about education in the politics has a very strong resonance for me in my interactions with parents at the kindergarten, and I would say that. It's not because I think Aristotle or 4th-century Greeks had some understanding of education that nobody ever had before, nobody ever had since, but rather that for whatever reasons we're blessed to have in the Aristotelian canon that got handed down a very long treatment of when children should be given musical instruments, how often they should be playing them, and in groups of what size, and things like this. I mean, I think this is a bizarre fact. No one would expect that, I don't think, right? You know, you see those volumes of collected Aristotle. No one would imagine that there are 14 pages and there would be more, except that they're lost, because the 8th book of the Politics ends and we don't know what comes after. But we have this very extended discussion of issues like this. And so, yes, I do think that it's part of my life, not just part of my research. So not only is it not only my research, it's not only my research and teaching, but not only is it not only just my research and teaching, it's also the way I live in general. And it's because of this, let's say, self-reflective character. So the methodological concerns, but again, in the sense of openness, of a kind of radical questioning of how every cultural practice gets done, and the sense that there might be a better way to do it. Of course, other people have done that, but there is a way in which this is recorded and transmitted for us in 5th and 4th century Greece that's fairly unique. And that's, I suppose, my role, I would say, as a researcher and an educator, is to share with others my experience of being blessed, which is the word I would want to use. There's a true happiness. This isn't a religious blessedness, but that a sense of great fortune that one has, and that I've had the opportunity to work on these materials carefully and to share them with people who might not have otherwise ever been encouraged to believe that there's something in these materials that's really relevant to their life. I've always had an uneasy relationship with intellectual authorities, I guess. And I suppose that what I think is really estimable about the way that we try to do things at ECLA is that we have profound respect, I believe, for what I would call natural inquisitiveness. So we have a tremendous respect, I think I speak for my colleagues. We have tremendous respect for the capacities of our students, and we also expect an awful lot more from them than is expected from most first-degree students in Europe, I would say, and certainly in North America. And I think that we can expect as much from our students as we do, precisely because we respect them as we do. And I think that this is really the cornerstone, and it does map very closely with the kind of undergraduate education I was fortunate to have, where it was made very clear to me by faculty members that though they'd read an awful lot, and in some cases had read a certain text or had familiarity with a certain object of attention that was much greater than what I could bring to the table at age 18 or 19. Nevertheless, my approach to the course material was just as likely to lead to new insights as anything they could bring to the material. And that's a hypothesis that would need empirical verification, so I wouldn't want to just assert that as being true because I say it, but I think that as more institutions pop up, they tend to be small, and they'll never be the majoritarian choice, but as more institutions develop that organize themselves this way, we'll see, in fact, that this is empirically verified, that undergraduate education is not about knowledge transfer in the traditional understanding that you have experts who, through the best methods, impart their knowledge on the recipients, on the consumers, but rather that knowledge transfer is much more organic. And to bring fire into the conversation, as I'm always happy to, is much more like sitting around a fire, right, and watching the heat of the fire, feeling the heat of the fire illuminate everybody. That's knowledge transfer does happen. It happens that way. It doesn't happen from one of the bodies to the other bodies. It happens from the atmosphere to all of the bodies. And that's an image, and I don't think it proves anything. But I think that we're the proof, so to say, that as our students ask questions at conferences, or, you know, people, for instance, our visitors in the most recent workshop, it never fails to be true that people say, "My God, you have such great students." And I say, you know, well, no, we have such a great model. If more people had this opportunity, more people would appear to be great students. So one of the great features of my undergraduate education was that I was given the opportunity to study for a semester in Oxford, and I happened to be there right at the time. So I was there at the time when OK Computer was being conceived. So this is a very fertile moment in the career of Radiohead, and I was living on the Cowley Road, which is very near to where Tom York had a place. I don't exactly know where that was, because that I wasn't shown, but he owned a club called the Zodiac, which was exactly 17 doors to the northwest of my house when we were living there. And so I was there just about every night. And yes, I got to experience the awesomeness that is the Radiohead vibe. And of course, like every peek behind the scenes, it's terribly disillusioning. So if I were to share anything that I actually learned in that basement, it would only undermine whatever positive impressions we might have of Radiohead. So I'll leave it at that. But it's true. I've had some very great experiences, but none of them are greater than what happens, and this is really true in seminars here at ECLA. So this is, you know, when I'm giving the story of my life to grandkids, if that ever happens, the stuff that I'll remember won't be the brushes with fame, but rather moments like discovering 472C again in seminar today.